You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, February 17th, 2010. This is episode 119. Sally and Tony meet. Welcome back, everybody. Time again for the Wells Tech Podcast. This is Martin Spriggs, and I am joined, as usual, by Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Martin. How are things in Milwaukee this morning?
The sun is shining, and I'm looking forward to the show again. We're at show 119, and we get to kind of have some closure on the show today. You stirred up a hornet's nest a few weeks, well, actually at the end of last year was now, when we put out our annual top three and bottom three picks of the year. And one of those bottom picks of the year was the Learning in Hand website, and now our friend Tony Vincent. And we heard that from the Tony Vincent fan club that wasn't such a good pick, or bottom pick, as it were, right?
That's right, a real learning experience for me, Martin. And the one thing I learned is I'm not participating in the worst picks of the year in 2010.
Oh, well, I've got the whole year to warm you up to that concept.
No, Tony was very gracious.
Tony came on the show, and we're going to play that interview a little bit later. So we had a great conversation with him, and he
Absolutely,
was really,
really sharp guy.
He was really gracious enough to do that in spite of the I don't know if we gave him bad press.
Well, you know, one thing that he wrote to us in the midst of all the conversation around our pick was that a lot of times people are really quick to jump on, look at this great resource, mm-hmm. look at that great resource, and toot a horn or whatever, but they don't really, you know, follow up and tell whether they're actually using it or it, you know, manifested itself in the way that they thought that it would.
Exactly.
So, you know, he appreciated that aspect of it. I think that the Learning in Hand website is very useful. And if you're a teacher out there in our listening audience, you definitely, you know, want to check it out. The usefulness, of course, is tempered by the fact that you need handheld devices to use a lot of the resources that are listed there. But more and more of those are getting into our classroom setting. So it's an exciting time.
So stay tuned for a little bit later in the podcast. But before that, we have a little bit of conversation to take care of about your favorite book, Sally. That is The Hidden Power of Electronic Culture.
You were teasing me a little. I thought you were going to have closure on this, Martin. But
No. We're only on chapter four.
But it's good stuff.
That's right. When I suggested that we go through this book, I knew that it would be, a tough row to hoe, as it were, because it's deep stuff, and you have to. I've read it three times now, and I think I'm beginning to understand, you know, some of the important concepts in the book, and chapter four really gets to the heart of a couple of the issues. So, those of you that are following at home, and we've been actually going through this about once a month, a chapter at a time. It's a book by Shane Hipps, who's a Mennonite pastor, who I think has some insightful thinking on how media shapes ministry. And so, in chapter four, it's entitled "Electronic Media: Planting the Seeds of the Emerging Church." There's really kind of three big ideas in this particular chapter. He talks about the telegraph, he talks about the radio, and he talks about pictures.
Right, Martin, and I think underlying everything he's saying here is the contrast between a modernistic way of thinking or philosophy and a postmodern philosophy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we hinted at that in some of our earlier discussions of the book, the shift from a text-based abstract kind of thinking mm-hmm. to a more image-based, iconic kind of thinking that is more concrete and that kind of thing. And and all three of these different media channels, telegraph, radio, and pictures, have transformed our way of thinking. And to take that step back and look at each one of them, you know, really gives you some food for thought. The telegraph, for instance, it broke down, he says, the connection between communication and transportation. And if you think back to before telegraph, you know, everything was very related to your small world,
your
that
geography,
you lived in.
Right? It was in the news. And he kind of compares the transition from the printed word, which had been really the only way to communicate other than verbal communication. And that printed word was very localized. So you had the local newspaper, and everything had a, what I guess I would call, a context. So when you read a newspaper story, it was in your community. It related to you. It had it's about the guy down the street or the local store, or it was something that you could relate to and have an opinion on. Now, when the telegraph comes along, and when he says it breaks down the connection between communication and transportation, the telegraph brought information from far-reaching places that could never have you could never have really received before. So instant communication, or at least the beginning of instant communication, and then the introduction of information that was without context. So it was happening halfway across the world, or you really didn't know what to make of it because it was a discrete piece of content. And then he talks about this concept of the meta narrative, which I'd never heard that term before, but it kind of makes sense. He said really the telegraph was the death of the meta narrative. So information comes from these many sources rather than in the context of your location. So there's no context. There's no overriding truth, which is kind of the meta narrative that helps us sort out how to feel or react to information. So as a result, it hasn't taken long, is his presupposition here, for people to see the truth claims of Scripture as no more valid than the claims of Dr. Phil, for instance.
Okay, and so here's where my brain slows down just a little. I'm following along and everything, and when he makes these jumps to,
yep,
and that applies to Scripture in this way, that's when I get a little bit more challenged. But I do think I understand what he's saying here, that, you know, we've had this overarching story, this Scripture belief that shapes everything in our lives, that God was reconciling himself to the world through Jesus Christ, our Savior. And when it just becomes one of the things in the context of all
of
the
many,
things that we're
right.
hit with, it doesn't have that overarching effect on the lives of the people of this world anymore.
Right.
So
that meta-narrative is God's word, and everything that we process should be in the context of the fact that we live in a world that God created and that we're creatures of, and that we have a purpose that God has planned out for us in advance, and that's how we should deal with information. So when information becomes just one of many things, the relativity of it, so to speak, becomes a little bit more diminished, where people say, well, that's your world. This is my world, when in truth, it's God's world, and we all have that that place in this whole meta narrative, this creation that God has put us in. So that was kind of revealing when we talk about the telegraph, because you never thought about it before. And then the radio kind of takes it to the next step, which is almost a step back when you're thinking about what the radio had done. Because it kind of reintroduced what he called the tribal experience, right?
Right. You know, the concept that we're huddled around and we're sharing a story at the same time, experiences, stories, songs, you know, all those kind of things around an audio experience.
Right,
and
rather than a visual,
Exactly. Made a big point in contrasting that with the visual, that you can close your eyes or you can look away, but audio surrounds you and it comes into your ears. You know, you don't escape the audio, portion. And so in that sense, you're right, it is kind of a step in the opposite direction of the effects of the telegraph, that we have these shared experiences, and that lends itself well to, you know, the shared Christian experience and the traditions around the oral sharing of that experience.
Yep, and we're not on our own, and it's more, you know, I envision more of kind of Jesus talking to his disciples concept, where there's context, there's sight, there's sound, there's an experience that's involved. And then finally he comes back to pictures versus words, and there were some interesting illustrations he shared there.
Yeah, this was kind of the big section of the chapter for sure. He saw a huge impact with the imagery that surrounds us now, the advent of photography and graphics and those kind of things, and the fact that the example he gave in the book was the written words, the boy is sad, versus a very telling image of a crying young man who, you know, maybe is in an African situation with starvation or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's just a very vivid image of a sad boy, you know, and the contrast between those two and the emotions and things that they evoke, and the fact that our world is moving more toward this image-based, you know, understanding of things and comfort level is a shift back to that image-based communication that we talked about earlier on in the book, with the alphabet and everything based on imagery, a very Eastern kind of thought process.
Right. Yeah. Picture is worth a thousand words, and then he went quickly on to say, "Well, that can both be good and bad." We often think that you know, imagery always enhances the message, but when you look at how we process that information, you know, it's a right brain versus left brain kind of conversation. So he kind of makes the point that we've come to rely maybe even too heavily on imagery and not enough on the written word, and it's reduced our ability for abstract thought and reasoning skills. And, you know, that brings with it some consequences. For instance, he suggests that, you know, in the political process, it's the good-looking candidates that get elected regardless, you know, of what they say. And I think there's some truth to that, you know, where even in the last election, where there was, you know, this is probably debatable, but the younger, you know, more energetic, you know, up-and-coming, good-looking candidate won over the older, you know, and they kind of made a big deal of John McCain's disability, his, you know, his arm that he couldn't move real well because of the war injury. And then that goes back to, you know, our dependence on right-brain thinking. So the image-based communication actually reduces our capacity for abstract or critical reasoning skills, regardless, really, of what the content is. And then what really kind of struck home for me, Sally, was he began to compare that to Paul's writings, and especially Paul's writings to the Romans. That's probably one of the hardest books to read and to talk about, because there's not a lot of, you know, just real concrete pictures. It's abstract thought. It's harder to think through Paul's writings. And he said that's one of the reasons that people have tended to gravitate lately more towards stories. And the stories of the Bible are the parables. But then he compared that to what Luther's great revelation was and what brought Luther around to the right thinking about justification and the, you know, sola gratia. And that was Luther's understanding of what book? You know, the book of Romans, right? So
sure.
Paul's writings, you know, he makes a point that Paul's writings are hard to depict in stained glass. And, you know, I think there's some, I'm not sure exactly what that tells us other than to say we really need both. You know, we need the visual, but we need the ability to process some hard thinking and some words that Paul put together that really make a difference in our life of faith.
And so, Martin, I'm wondering if we can skip to the end of the book now, because we need a solution.
That's right.
You know, I think that We, as Wisconsin-Synod Lutherans, very much value, you know, the, I guess he calls it systematic theology, the study of that word in deep detail. And if the world doesn't value that, you know, how do we convince them of its worth if they're moving toward this Eastern approach, this image-based and not abstract thinking that that's involved with the printed word?
And that is a differentiator from our church, with our church body, from others, is that we are a confessional church, that we dig deep and we take every word literally, and we we hold great importance, we attach great importance to our theology and what we teach in our doctrine and our dogma or dogmatics. So I'm not sure we're going to get to an answer. Again, I've read this book now. This is my third time, and I don't know that we're going to get to an answer. I think the point of the book, however, is to get us thinking about the channels, about the media, rather than just the medium, rather than just the message. To say that we can separate those two is not an accurate statement, and I think that's what we'll ultimately get to at the end of the book. That's kind of the big idea, you know, of the hidden power of electronic culture. So
maybe even am getting that just a little bit.
Okay.
Watch out.
All right. Let's get on to the interview with Tony Vincent. Again, we referenced that at the top of the show. Tony was good enough to come on the show. The fact that we were talking about him was called to his attention. He mentions that in the interview. And as a result, we thought, hey, why don't we just get him on the show and let him talk in person about, you know, why he believes that handheld devices are important in the classroom. And I think he makes a good point. So let's take a listen to our interview with Tony Vincent, learninginhand.com. Joining us today is Tony Vincent, who a former fifth grade teacher and now into consulting and really teaching teachers about technology and specifically mobile technology. He runs a website called Learning in Hand. Welcome, Tony. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
And Tony, you are in the warm climes of Phoenix, Arizona, correct?
Yes, I'm in sunny Phoenix, Arizona, though one of our rare days is actually raining today.
Ah, okay, the one day of the season, right?
I'm originally from Nebraska. I've lived in Phoenix about a year. So you did your time. I did my time, so I deserve it now, I think.
Okay, very good. Well, you've got a little bit of a history with you, although we've never met. This is the first time we've talked. Sally, in one of her picks of the year, encouraged our listeners to take a look at learninginhand.com, which is your website. And then at the end of the year, we try and pick our three best and three worst of our picks of the year, and you happen to fall on that latter list. And that created quite a stir amongst the Tony Vincent fan club, and we felt that it would be great to have you on to talk a little bit more about your site and what you do. So maybe just for our audience, if you could maybe introduce yourself, what you're currently doing, and just a little bit about who Tony Vincent is and what you care about at this point.
All right. Well, it's really weird to have a fan club, but I do have quite a following of people because they enjoy my website, and I think it was they just saw, kind of like I did in my newsreader, it popped up that anytime somebody mentions my website, you know, it comes into my news aggregator, and I take a look and it says worst pick. I'm like, what? What is going on here?
What did I do wrong?
I know. What's wrong? So then I had to listen. But hey, now it got us talking. So it worked out great. Well, I taught elementary school for 8 years in Omaha, Nebraska. And it was at Willowdale Elementary School, which prides itself on being a leader in educational technology. And in fact, in 2001, my students were part of a pilot project, and they each got a Palm handheld and keyboard. And it was really exciting for each student to have their own computer. At that time, laptops were just so expensive, $2,000 or more, that it just wasn't feasible to have laptops for every student. Mm-hmm. And I had been using a Palm myself as a personal organizer, a way to keep track of my students and my life. And so I thought, well, let's I'm all for this pilot. Let's give it a try. And it turned out to be a great experience for everybody. The students loved it. They learned lots from it. They came to school more often. They were excited about learning. I loved it because my students actually had some of the tools I wanted them to have. Mm-hmm. So Palms back in 2001, there was no Wi-Fi on them. They were pretty limited. We actually had color models, but most of them were in black and white in 2001.
Sure.
We ended up using applications that were out there that were designed for business people and adapting them to the curriculum. And when we wanted a database of vocabulary words, we ended up putting them in the address book as, you know, the last name was the word and the descriptor was the address, you know, just manipulating them
all
in a way.
All kinds of workarounds. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was quite a movement where a lot of schools across the country and across the world saw that, you know, this is a little computer that can do great things. And so they started developing software for them. And so we have software like Sketchy where students can do a frame-by-frame animation. So they draw, change a little bit on a new frame, draw, change a little bit, and then they've had this animation they can share with other people. So animating long division problems or their vocabulary words, or making a little cartoon about the gold rush, you know, whatever they made an animation of, they remembered forever. And apps like that, concept mapping, all that, it was great. And so we had a website called Planet Fifth, and that was where I put all my student work online. And it was really, even then, schools and classrooms didn't have their own websites, but I knew I wanted to publish student work online. So we put videos and artwork and pictures and writing up there. So it became a pretty popular place. And then we had a section all about our using Palms. We called that the Learning in Hand. It was a section of Planet Fifth. And more and more people would Google search and they're interested in it. So we'd add more to the site. And pretty soon the Learning in Hand section got so big, it became its own website, which is now at learninginhand.com. Mm-hmm. And we actually had people fly in from the coasts to spend the day in our classroom because people really wanted to see what students were doing with handheld computers. And then I got asked to speak at conferences, and I wrote a couple books, and then it became my life somehow.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. But even at Willowdale, we were the first elementary school to have a podcast in the United States. It's called Radio Willow Web. It's still going today. And that really ties into what we do with handhelds now, because unlike what we had in 2001, things like the iPod Touch really is the number one handheld nowadays. It can do everything we can do with the Palm, plus so much more, and much more multimedia. And students can create podcasts and then view them on things like the iPod, which is great. Mm-hmm.
It is great, Tony, and I'm just so excited to hear your enthusiasm for it. You know, I got a big kick out of a blog that I read the other day. It said, if I'm reading the tea leaves of education technology correctly, it looks like it's going to be about time for teachers that are technophobic to start looking at retirement plans or career options. And the reason that they were pointing to that was because of the iPad announcement from Apple and how they're saying that's just going to revolutionize education. And obviously, you and the work that you've done have been on the cutting edge of that revolution now for 9 years since 2001. So that's pretty amazing, pretty exciting to see. Going back to me picking your site as a worst pick, the philosophy that I had there, flawed as it may have been, was that our schools may not be quite ready for that. And I guess, you know, I'd be really curious to hear what you think and how you're seeing handhelds adopted in schools. You know, is it something that is a reasonable alternative for schools at this point?
Yeah, well, it's come a long way. I like to reminisce about the good old days in 2001 where the parents in my classroom couldn't figure out why we were giving students electronic organizers. And now I don't think anybody thinks that. When they see a handheld, I think they get the idea. Yeah, it's a real live computer that you can carry around in your hand, and mostly because so many people have smartphones that can do great things too. What I'm seeing with schools across the country is they're still doing a lot of pilot programs. a lot of them with iPod touches and iPods now, and then also with netbooks, which are kind of what Apple's iPad is the mm-hmm. answer to, and those are the small and expensive laptops. It's still highly mobile. But I see pilot programs, maybe individual school initiatives, and then there are some district-level rollouts, particularly with they have a grant to do all this, because you know it does take some money up front to buy the devices, for sure.
Just so we have full disclosure, my family of five has 4 iPod touches in our possession, including my sixth grader and my fourth grader. And my fourth grade teacher just said to me, "Boy, he showed me what that iPod touch can do. I'm so impressed." You know, so you know, I think there are pockets of tech oriented people that see the potential even with their children having these types of devices. But just at a school level, you know, it's got to be hard to make that jump into the handheld. And then, you know, technology changes so quickly, and how can you invest in one platform when things are going to change very quickly? It's got to be a real challenge for school districts.
The platform thing is a big deal. I mean, it looks like the iPhone/iPod touch platform is here to stay for a while. But, you know, I was a big advocate of Palms, and they just didn't keep up, and now they don't even make anything with that
not
same operating system
right.
anymore.
Yeah.
No. But what I think is most exciting for me, even though there are over 160,000 apps in the App Store for the iPod Touch, I think what's more exciting is when we have a mobile browser, because they're what they call web apps. Mm-hmm. And that is, it doesn't matter, as long as your browser supports the latest HTML version, then you can do amazing things right there in your browser. So it could be an iPod Touch, or it could be a Palm smartphone or an Android phone. But they can all get to it. And that's what's really holding schools back, is it's kind of like back in the old days, which I guess we still have this Mac or Windows kind of thing. It's like, what platform do we go with, and is it going to change? But if the common denominator is the web itself, it doesn't matter the device.
Yeah, you're platform independent at that point, yeah.
Exactly. Right. And then schools have to kind of be ready for not iPods, but pods, mm-hmm. personally mm-hmm. owned devices, where students are bringing in, you know, instead of the school providing these or buying them. Just this last Christmas, I bet a lot of teachers surveyed their classrooms. You're going to find out there were a heck of a lot of iPod touches
right.
sold around the country. And so instead of, you know, banning them, invite them in. Of course, that brings in a whole load of issues of students bringing in their own devices. Mm-hmm. But it's one way to achieve some one-to-one computing inexpensively.
Sure. What I guess the proof is always in the pudding. As you implemented this in your classroom, what demonstrable results, you know, on the back end did you see? Were their grades better? Were they more engaged? Did it open up new doors that you hadn't had open before? What was the result of the work?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Okay.
You know, we didn't do any scientific research, and in fact, if you go to look, there's not a ton out there saying, you know, this is definitely research proven. I can just tell you from the atmosphere in my classroom, particularly because my students were under such a microscope, and visitors come in,
right,
and
right.
you know, getting emails every day. It was a big deal, but it just. The way that students interacted with each other, you know, they knew the ones who were kind of specialists in one piece of software or another, and they just helped each other out. I just every year when I use Palms, I know I always had great students, but I think the handhelds somehow changed the atmosphere in the classroom to where they were sharing more often. They were showing their animations to each other and problem solving. And then there are so many great study tools that we had with handhelds that students could take these home. They could study anytime, anywhere. They did do better on tests because they had the tools to study, and they were often games mm-hmm. or even Quizler, which was, you know, just giving you text quizzes. But the key there is they gave instant feedback, so they didn't have to, you know, I guess they could use flashcards and get instant feedback, but the computer gave them the feedback and they didn't have to wait for, you know, some worksheet they filled out for me and then get it back and not care about the results. So they were more likely to study and they did a better job studying because they had the tools.
So Tony, let's just give us a quick tour of that Learning in Hand website that grew from your Planet Fifth, and what are some of the hot spots on the website? I know it's looked to as definitely a standard that many look to for direction if they're getting into the handheld education realm. So where would we start there?
Yeah, you know, the first link across the top is the blog, which might be overwhelming because, as you probably know, a blog is organized in reverse chronological order. So you just kind of see what's newest there, and it's not really pieced together in any way. So then across the top of the website, the two most popular sections are the podcast section. In particular, I offer for free a 34-page PDF booklet that takes Mac or Windows users through the whole process of making an audio podcast, where to find sound effects and how to mix it down, even how to add artwork to your podcast. And so that's been popular. And then the other part is the iPod section, in particular the iPod Touch pages. There's tips and tricks, links to just blog posts about the iPod Touch. It's funny because I'm actually in the middle of redesigning all this to make it easier for teachers, particularly ones who are brand new to the iPod Touch, giving them some resources they read first so they really can dive in and get their questions answered right away when they're wondering about iPod Touches. But yeah, you know, the podcasts and iPods are what's hot on the website right now.
Are there curriculums that are being developed around handheld devices that you're aware of or that you've been involved with?
You know, there's websites here and there that will add lesson plans, but you know, really what I like about the handhelds is how easy they are to slip into the curriculum you mm-hmm. already have.
Okay.
You know, there's apps that will support what you're doing. You're studying the environment. Well, then, oh, you can get an app that calculates your ecological footprint, and you're writing something. You can get an app to write and, you know, highlight your adjectives and make them better. And so it's really, you got lesson plans, and then you can just infuse what you already do, or infuse the iPod into what you already do with your curriculum.
Have you been contacted by Apple or any kind of educational software developers for input or suggestions?
Well, app developers email me a lot with their apps because they want me to write about them.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
and then, you know, I know people from Apple, but okay. they like to do things their own way. Anyhow, that's Apple for you. But what I do have some ideas for apps. You know, with 160,000 apps, you'd think every idea has been gone over, but it's mm-hmm. not true. Cause with Palm developers, we actually, my students and I, yeah, we helped develop, I don't know any programming, but we came up with the ideas and gave feedback to about a dozen different Palm apps.
Oh, cool.
And it was great because my students could test them and then we'd send it back. Most of them were done by a gentleman in Canada and in Denmark.
Oh,
and so we're communicating to different countries. Uh-huh.
That's
a neat
experience for the kids too, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And so, and it's the same kind of community, maybe even bigger for the iPod Touch and iPhone, is that now that there are 160,000 apps, they're looking for good ideas to make
sure.
into other apps. So someday, what I did with the Palms is I made this wish list and put it on my site and mocked up screens. And I need to do that again for the iPod Touch because that's what really got developers' attention.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So what's next? Can you look into your crystal ball and predict the future for us in terms of handheld and education integration?
Well, it really seems like handhelds that are bigger, like the iPad and tablet computing, are going to be big because textbook companies are starting to get on
right.
board with this stuff.
Right.
And that's what, you know, whatever textbooks do, schools are going to do. And so if you know, imagine you pay $400 or $500 for a tablet computer, but then you have your textbooks on there. Now, they're not going to offer their textbooks for free, I'm sure, so it'll be an interesting math equation to see how the budgets work out. But I think where you have interactive textbooks that are automatically updated and students don't have to break their backs bringing them back and forth to school, I think there is a lot of potential there. And then, like I said, the pods, the personally owned devices, I think in the next 5 years, there'll be quite a few schools reworking that. I recently spoke with a principal at a school in Tucson, a high school, and they started at the beginning of the school year having students able to bring in their personally owned devices. And like, well, what happened? Did your school crumble to the ground? Because there are people who just think that this would destroy a school. And I'm like, no, we've had no problems at all. You know, with the exception of, you know, a couple bizarre instances, they've had absolutely no problems at all. And I think if we get more schools to dip their little toe into this and find out that it's not the end of the world if students bring in their own computers, we might be onto something there too.
So how does so if one of our listeners is saying, hey, I think this is a great idea, I've kind of bought into the fact that this could enhance the educational experience, how does somebody get started? Obviously, budgets are tight. Do schools that are kind of engaged in this go for grants, or do they kind of build this into a registration fee, or how do you see schools implementing this?
Well, they do it in different ways. I mean, I think with your schools being private, they can probably do a little more with it than public schools. The public schools are having a hard time requiring students to have an iPod Touch, you know. But retailing for about $180, you know, schools seem to have no problem requiring a graphing calculator.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know, which is a very similarly priced. So you can get a graphing calculator app for the iPod Touch, and it can do so much more. So they're thinking of it in that way. Mm-hmm. But some are requiring it. That's not happening too often, but grants and I tell teachers too, if they're interested in it, start small. Just get like 3 to 5, and a lot of local organizations have grants that will be, you know, when they're that size of grant, they're easier to get than the thousands of dollar grants. And load them up with some podcasts and with some apps and set them up as a center or a club or something, and just discover how students react to them. Because when you see their faces light up, and when they show you something you didn't know how to do or had no clue it could do, and they're like, hey, look what I did,
right?
Then you're gonna then you'll really see the potential, and you'll want more than 3 to 5.
Right.
You'll want to get more, and you'll find a way to get them.
So is
that's
there
why my fourth grader has one, so he can teach me how to use it, so.
For sure. Well, in fact, that's what we're seeing, is that a lot of pre-K and kindergarten classes are getting these, because
is that right?
there are a lot of apps out there for those who can't type, and then it's very multimedia, so it teaches them letter sounds, and there's even podcasts out there like Hooked on Phonics. So the students can play those over and over again, so they're actually
interesting,
quite good for the lower grade levels.
How do you handle a 5 or 6 year old handling a $200 device? You know, they're not the most careful with anything that they're grabbing onto.
Yeah, you know, they love it so much that they take pretty good care of it. And you know, you can get cases and things
for
them that mine's taken a drop. I think everybody's have taken a drop, and most of the time there's not a problem that happens. You know, there's a few cracked screens, but same with when I had Palms. You know, they're like, oh, the fifth graders are taking it home, they're doing this and they're doing that. We had one that ever broke from a drop.
Okay.
And that was somebody walking by flailing their hands, and it was on the corner of the desk. So we learned, never keep your hand held on the corner of the desk, keep it in the middle, so that people walking by don't accidentally knock it off. But you know, they've hit the ground lots of times. Of course, the whole class gasps, and then then they're afraid to pick it up. And then when they look at it and they see that there's no cracks and it's working, everybody's fine.
Right.
Big sigh of relief.
Yep.
Tony, thanks so much for taking some time out of your day. I'm sure you've got many other. I don't know. Do you do a lot of podcasts? Yeah, I know you do your own, but do you talk to other folks like us who are interested in what you have to say?
I do. I'm doing a series of webinars for schools that are getting iPod touches in Nevada across the state of Nevada
through
a grant.
Very cool.
And I'm working on, I have a podcast called Learning in Hand iPods, and I'm working on an episode right now for specifically for these teachers next week, where it's the do's and don'ts of having an iPod touch in the classroom.
Okay.
And I think that's going to be helpful for a lot of people. Instead of having to reinvent the wheel, people can see what works for others.
Absolutely.
And jump in that way.
Evangelize that way, for sure.
Yep. Cool. Yep. And then I have other podcasts and things online. I have a website, tonyvincent.net. If you go there, it's feeds from all the things I do. I have another podcast called tonyvincent.info where I just kind of share really informally, and I record it on my iPod and post it to the web right from my iPod. I don't even use a computer for it, where I just talk about the links I found that day, random thoughts. And then I have a blog. This is probably going to be the most interesting to your listeners, for the Arizona K-12 Center. It's at azk12.org. And that's where I write about a web-based tool. So you don't need a handheld for these things. It's you just need the web and a browser and a computer. It doesn't even matter if you're Mac or Windows.
Right.
And you know, I could write all day about these about web-based tools, because there's new ones coming out all the time and great examples of how students and teachers are using these free resources.
Right. Well, certainly a fertile area, and you've got plenty of material, and sounds like you've got a great approach to it. And it sounds like you're having a good time too.
Oh, you know, I love teaching fifth grade. It was an absolute blast. And then this is even more fun.
Cool.
Believe it or not.
Very cool. So we'll put all the links that we mentioned in the show notes. And thanks so much again, Tony, for joining us. Appreciate the time.
Great. You are welcome. I've had a good time myself.
Thanks again to Tony. I am glad that we got a chance to do that, Sally.
Absolutely. I love his acronym, the PODs, the personally owned devices. And I think, you know, he's definitely onto something, provided us with a load of great links that we'll have in our show notes, and wish him all the best. And we'll certainly be following his progress over time and watching his website for new updates.
Yeah, I'd be interested to get Gail Potritz's reaction. She's going to be on the show next week to see if she has any experience with handheld devices in the classroom, or anybody else, you know, for that matter. Next week's show is our classroom technology focused show, and this fits in nicely with that too. So, good stuff. And you know, we've had a number of great interviews lately about technology in the classroom. We had the Schlossers on a couple weeks back talking about photography in the classroom. And boy, technology really is taking center stage in a lot of these learning initiatives.
Absolutely. Exciting time to be a teacher.
It is. Ministry resources. We have one thing that I ran across the other day that I wanted to share, and it kind of ties in nicely with a email that we got from Chris Sonnenberg from St. Marcus in Milwaukee. He was wondering if we had any ideas on how to quickly and easily get sermons online. Apparently, his hosting provider does not provide an easy way to do that. And I ran across a resource that solves that problem. It's called Sermon Drop. I think it's sermondrop.com. They advertise it, and I don't have any experience with this, so I'm just passing this along. So there's the disclaimer. But a plain and simple way to podcast sermons. You sign up, and all the hosting's provided. You simply upload the MP3 file that you've recorded. It takes care of the RSS feed. You add descriptions. You can get this for free for up to 10 sermons. I think you can delete sermons as they rotate off. They give you a link. They give you an embed code, and it sounds just dumb simple. If all you have is the MP3 file and you're really not quite sure how to publish it, this is maybe a thing for you to look at, sermondrop.com.
And we should also just post a reminder to our listeners that they can look back at our recent podcast 117, where we talked about how we make our podcast magic happen.
Yep.
And maybe they'll get some ideas from that as well. And we have a Wells Tech Wiki page dedicated to podcasting too. So lots of resources there for you, Chris. We're happy to have you listening.
Yep, and we're glad that you're doing that. I think a lot of congregations are interested in at least getting the audio portion of the sermon up and online, and it's easier than ever to do. News and tech. Sally, there's some buzz in the news and tech area.
Yep. Google has released yet another new product. It's called Google Buzz. And if you're a Gmail user, it pretty much was forced upon you this week. So check it out and see what you think. Martin, you and I had some Google Buzz communication going on. And it is meant to be a foray of Google into the social networking kind of arena, a competitor of Facebook and Twitter, I guess.
Yep.
And it does allow you to follow people, to have their buzz and your buzz stream. And I think Google got a little heat right off the bat
yeah.
with some of that following technology and the privacy associated with it, but they're tweaking that, and hopefully you know, a new entrant. I don't typically go to my Gmail account in the web-based interface. I use an email client, so,
so you don't
if
ever
you do
see
go
the
to
interface,
your Gmail,
right?
you would see it, you know, front and center. But if not, it's not something you'd even know that existed.
Yeah, if you're a heavy Gmail user, I think this is a nice complement to, let's say, your social networking repertoire. You can connect some of your other social networking sites. Google Reader has had some of these features all along where you could comment and like and share. So they've integrated that, and I think that's kind of the primary technology here. But you can connect your Twitter feed, Flickr, Picasa, which is their photo sharing site. I was kind of surprised because I immediately had, you know, X number of followers, and I didn't know half of them. And I think that was related to their security issues that they really hadn't thought through. So I had to block a few people that I didn't really know and didn't want to kind of let into the inner circle there of what I wanted to share. But now I think I've got a handle on it, and it's really easy to use. It. One nice thing for Gmail users is that you're automatically notified if somebody comments on one of your posts. So it's a nice feature for, you know, the heavy Google/Gmail user. So we'll see where it goes. You can insert inline pictures and videos. And it's really easy to do, and I think that's one of the goals that Google had. And again, we're going to have to spend some time talking about social networking. I was able to give a presentation early last week to a pastor's conference on social networking and how it has an impact on ministry, whether we, you know, whether we like it or not, or whether we see it coming or not. It's coming, and we need to prepare for that. And our members are certainly in the social networking landscape, and we got to figure out how best to use that for ministry, and that's kind of what this show is about. So we'll spend some time later talking about social networking. That's always, I think, a topic that I think churches have to figure out and are somewhat confused on how best to, you know, do we have a Facebook page? Do we need a Twitter account?
Do we need a Buzz account?
Do we need now? Or do we need a Buzz account? Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. We do have a video link that we'll include in the show notes. It's just a quick overview of Google Buzz. So if you haven't seen it and are curious, that would be a good way to get an introduction to it. And I guess, Martin, you said if you have a Gmail account, you get the emails. Can you have Buzz without a Gmail account?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. So if you don't have a Gmail account and you want to try it out, I think you would start by getting a Gmail account.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So, and I don't know that it's compelling enough to go to that length. I would think this is more for existing Gmail users who maybe don't aren't involved in social networking, and maybe this is their toe in the water. So interesting concept. We'll keep an eye on it.
Okay.
Picks of the week. Sally, what's your pick this week?
Well, I had to laugh because I was kind of behind the reading curve and trying to catch up on my book reading for our discussion in this show. Before I did my reading, I picked my pick, and it's an image pick. So it goes well with our discussion because images are very important.
That's right.
Especially if you're trying to have a world-class website, which has some great graphics on it. I found a new resource for royalty-free images. It's called unprofound.com.
I've not heard of that.
Basically, just stock imagery that's available for free download and use on your site. Their caveat is that you can't redistribute it in any way, but you can use it on your site. And what I like about it is it's organized by color. Just a real simple interface, and you pick on, click on the color scheme that you're interested in, and not a lot of choices there, you know, just your basic red, orange, yellow, green, blue, you know, rainbow kind of colors. Uh-huh. But you get a variety of images presented to you that fit within that kind of color scheme. And so helpful if you're in the pinch and need a nice image to offset your website in some way. So check out unprofound.com.
Yeah, it looks fairly new. How did you come across this, Sally?
This was a Twitter lead that I got from somebody I follow. I don't quite remember.
Yeah, it looks fairly new because there's not a lot of photos here yet. So I think it's just a burgeoning website. But I like their model of color. You can also do this, I believe. Let me go to my Google homepage here. And I think you can do this with Google Images too, can't you? Let's say Bell. I'm going to show options.
There is a search trick.
Yep, absolutely. And so if you're searching on an image and you search on show options at the top, then you have that any color down at the bottom, so you can specify your color. So I think that is an important concept if you're trying to unify the look of your website by color or color theme, so that you don't have contrasting colors that aren't in the same family. And I'm not great on color management, so these kind of sites are really helpful.
You know, I'll take any of the help I can get.
Absolutely. So. Good pick. My pick is actually similar to a pick I had as one of my top three picks for last year. I picked Backblaze for a pick of the year a while back, which is a cloud-based backup solution. I ran across another one that had been around for a while, and I was aware of it, but hadn't tried it. And what prompted me to try it was a pro version that they recently launched. It's called Carbonite. Carbonite Pro is the name of the package, carbonitepro.com. And what I like about it is it's good for small to medium-sized businesses. And that's what a lot of our churches and schools, you know, are classified as, is kind of that small business classification. And what's nice about it is you pay for this cloud-based storage by the number of gigabytes that you're storing, not by the number of clients or users or computers that you have. So if you have some users that don't have a lot to back up, you don't get stung with a high backup charge because they have a computer on the system. So you can have as many computers as you want, and you're only paying by the number of gigabytes that are stored. And the pricing is fairly reasonable. You can have an unlimited number of computers. It works totally in the background. It's cross-platform. You can have multiple admins managing it. There's an iPhone app as well where you can get at your files, your backed-up files. But you install the software, and ultimately it just works in the background. You don't even know that it's running. And all of a sudden, everything that you need backed up is backed up in the cloud. For under 20 gigabytes, it's $10 a month. It goes all the way up to 499 gigabytes for $250 a month, which is not bad when you consider that it just works, and you can send invitations to people. You can get reports on how many gigabytes they're storing or when the last backup happened. So if something has gone awry, you can, as a system administrator, you can get a report that something went wrong. So I think this is kind of a nice fit for churches and schools to consider if they're looking into cloud-based storage. Let's say they don't have a network administrator, or they don't have a central server that they can back up to. Cloud-based storage seems to be a nice solution for this. Of course, you would need an internet broadband internet connection to do the backup, but works very well.
You know, Martin, You were really good about reminding us about backups, and every time you do that, it really convicts me because I'm not good at doing backups, and so maybe now's the time for me to jump on the backup
Now is the
bandwagon.
time. Yeah, I like Backblaze, and I'm still using that, but we're testing out this Carbonite Pro just here in the Synod office because we've got some remote workers like yourself who do have local file issues that need to be taken care of. So if you store files on your desktop or in your My Documents, that's what this is really good at backing up. And it does versioning, too. So if you overwrite it or you delete it, there is a chance to go back and get it. So good stuff.
Sounds good.
Sally, you want to remind everybody about our training coming up?
We do have some training coming up. It's called Final Web for Dummies. Not that you guys that are listening are dummies by any means, but a catchy title for us there. Mm-hmm. You can find details out at bit.ly/FW4Dummies. And we're going to be doing the training in Milwaukee and New Ulm in the early weeks of March, mm-hmm. and in Saginaw, Michigan in the beginning of April. Registration is coming to a close very quickly for Milwaukee and New Ulm locations. So if you haven't registered and you're intending to, please do visit that website, bit.ly/FW4Dummies, and get signed up.
Yeah, the Milwaukee class is definitely almost full. We just got a couple more registrations, or I got notification that we would have a couple more coming. So we do have limited space and availability. I think there is still space in the New Ulm class. There's definitely space in the Saginaw class, but that's a little bit later. That's the second week in April, the week after Easter. So take
Join
advantage
us.
Of that.
Should
yeah,
be
we,
a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. Community feedback.
Well, we heard from lots of our listeners this week, starting off with a listserv conversation around our last show, mm-hmm. where we talked about church logos. We heard from Pastor John Gunther at Trinity in Marshfield, Wisconsin, and they're looking at creating a logo and, you know, kind of worried about it being too busy. Mm-hmm. And interesting feedback from Cindy Krieger, who's at Shepherd of the Hills in Lansing, Michigan, and also a State of Michigan employee working on the website for the State of Michigan. And she says she's not a logo designer, but she has some real good logo test. And I thought this was really simple and funny, kind of. She says copy it on a photocopier and reduce it down to fit on an envelope.
Yep.
And if it isn't readable, if it becomes a blob, then your logo is too busy and not defined well enough. And I think that's a great test for your logo.
Mm-hmm. So, great idea.
Good feedback there. Mm-hmm. There was also some tweets with Pound Wells Tech. We heard from Jason Schmidt, who's a teacher at Gethsemane in Omaha, Nebraska. And he shared a link to the best resources for beginning to learn about Twitter. And I think there's plenty of people who are just trying to figure Twitter out, and this may be a good place to get started. So thanks for that link, Jason. Also on Twitter, we heard from Nancy Thompson, who is a member of Victory of the Lamb in Franklin, Wisconsin, and she shared the news that Aviary is now free.
Mm-hmm.
And Aviary is online
Image editing
mm-hmm. Package, exactly, a complete package which has a lot of different resources there, vector image editing, all kinds of different things. And they have just gone with a free business model. And up until this point, some of the more advanced features were pay only, you know. So it's nice that they've opened it up and everything is free at this point. So if you're looking for online image editing, that may be a great place for you to start.
I'm going to have to try that. I've used Picnic for a long time, and I know you have too, Sally. Uh-huh. That works really well. But I'm hearing a lot of great things about Aviary, and now that it's free and they've opened up all the stuff here, I'm just looking on their site now. They've got image editing, color editing, vector editing, effects editor, image markup, screen capture, and now they have even audio editing. This seems like a nice toolkit for the creative team of a congregation to take advantage of.
And I just love it that it's all in the cloud. So,
it is, yeah, absolutely. And free.
Really Yeah,
as
good
in
prize
beer,
point.
yes.
All right. Had some communication via the Wells Tech Wiki from Marin McPeak, who's a member of St. Mark's in Citrus Heights, California. And Marin actually works with the public school system there, and they have gone toward using Promethean interactive whiteboards. And they've tested out both smart boards and Promethean, and they have decided to go the Promethean route. She sent us a link to PrometheanPlanet.com, where there's a lot of online resources for those using the Promethean brand whiteboards. And she suggested that she might have some more resources to share. So we've set up a brand new wiki page dedicated to Promethean. And if you're a Promethean user out there and want to add to our wiki resources, that would be great. And hopefully over time, Marin and others will build up resources for those that use the Promethean brand of whiteboards.
Very good. It's my old stomping grounds. My brother was married in that congregation, Citrus Heights, California.
How about that?
About this time of year, I miss the warmer climes of Northern California.
Yeah, something about 20 snow days from school makes you feel that way.
Exactly.
Hi.
All right.
Redeemer Yakima, Washington was in the news for technology. It was exciting.
It's nice, yeah.
Yeah. Did a really good
Congratulations,
job.
Congratulations, guys.
Local television station picked up on the fact that they're on Facebook and getting a lot of hits via the World Wide Web on their different sermon video. They didn't mention that it was closed caption, but I know John Shoesmith has worked really hard on the closed captioning of those videos, and it has definitely paid off with a lot of worldwide audience for the gospel message coming out of Redeemer. So check out their news coverage, and congratulations on that.
Yeah, and I'll be using that video as a resource in my social networking presentation from now on. That's great. That's great news there.
It definitely is. John also wrote to us to share the fact that he had found a little $13 device for sale on Amazon.com, which basically allows you to capture video and feed it into your computer via a USB port. And it's called an EasyCap USB. I think we've talked before about some similar type devices. I'm not sure if they were at that price point though. $13 is
Yeah, this sounds like a great price point. If it works well, that's a great value. We've talked about Pinnacle before, and that's what we use sometimes in our synod work. It's called Dazzle. I think there's a bunch of items in that Dazzle line, which essentially do the same thing. I think this does hook up through your USB. But on the other end, you have all kinds of audio and video feeds. So you have your regular video feed, but then you can have S video, and then of course your audio feeds coming in, and the computer just translates that and turns it into digital.
So John says you can use a digital SLR, a PowerShot, or any video camera that has
an AV
audio
plug,
video
right?
out plug. Yeah. So it kind of opens up the fact. I know in our congregation we have a nice camera for our worship setting in our sanctuary, but being able to do any kind of live streaming or whatever from our basement where we have Bible classes and stuff, it's just more of a challenge. We don't want to have to move the camera constantly,
right.
That kind of thing, you know. And so being able to use some of the less expensive camera equipment that we have available to us with a $13 plug sounds like a really good solution. So.
Are you thinking about doing that, Sally?
I'm thinking of ordering one. Give it a try.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
So I have to give you an update if we do.
Cool.
You mentioned earlier that we had had a recent interview with Pete Slessor and his daughter Carrie on photography in the classroom. Pete wrote to us with some updates on what's going on with him and his photography, and just lots of exciting things going on. They're working on finishing up the book on photography in the classroom, and expect that to be out in the future. And he started another book, a photo travel book on Northern Ireland and Scotland. So
that sounds like a cool trip. He's going there in May with 12 students from his photojournalism class.
He teaches at UW-Stout, taking students there. That sounds like a great trip. He also said his wife is going to Haiti with the Wells Kingdom Workers and is going to be nursing there in Haiti for the month of March. And he's planning to go down as well. So looking at ideas for a photo project around that trip as well.
Yep. We haven't talked a lot about Kingdom Workers on this show, but they're doing some great things. And if you're interested in doing some volunteer work with Wells Kingdom Workers, wkw.wells.net is the place to go.
Very good.
And finally, I want to give a shout out to Pastor Thomas Wilsman, who I met for the first time last week. We met for lunch with he and his technology crew. They came up from Waterloo, St. Paul's in Waterloo, Wisconsin. And they're exploring some technology improvements to their website and their infrastructure. And we had a great lunch over at Moe's Irish Pub and talked technology. So he mentioned he was a faithful and loyal listener and an avid Mac user, so we could relate on a couple different levels. And thank you for listening, Pastor Tom, and good luck and blessings with your technology improvements there at St. Paul's in Waterloo. Keep listening.
Very good. I think that wraps up our community feedback for today, Mark.
Let's close the old mailbag and let's think about next week. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, we are going to be focusing on classroom technology and talk about YouTube in the classroom. Obviously, YouTube's been around for a while, but we haven't really focused on its ministry uses, especially in the classroom. YouTube is the second most popular search engine in the world. Also, we hope to have an interview with the folks at Hope School, who had a lot of press lately about a parody video that they put online.
That's right. That's what kind of got us thinking about YouTube because they've had huge success. Their video's gone viral. Over 300,000 people have viewed the Scholar Ladies, and if you haven't, you should. So, really excellent work that they're doing there at Hope School in Milwaukee, and we're excited to get to talk to them. Had to get in line because they've been interviewed by a lot of media lately. So,
That's
exciting
right.
stuff.
That's right. So tune in next week for that. Let's close the show with some brand new music. When I was out in Minnesota early last week doing this presentation to the pastors' conference on social networking, ran into Pastor Chris Christensen, who recently released a CD. Cross to Glory is the name of his band. It's really just him and a guitarist. Some nice music on their album Life Song. We're going to play the first track on that newly released album, You Know I Know. Crosstoglory.com is the place to find that out. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We will talk to you next week.
You know when I sit and I write, you know me complete. You know all I've said and I've done. You know what I think. You've known me since I was a child, from inside the womb. My days will not pass from your eyes. So where can I go? You'll always know. Now I know your grace. I know your loving face. I know your word is true. So my hopes, dreams, and fears. You know all the pain that I mean, all my tears. You know the faith in my heart, my trust in you. You promised you'd never depart. So where can I go? You'll always know. Now I see that I needed you, Lord, from the cancer within. You know that I needed your son, his life and his cross. In him I will always be known. So where can I go? You'll always know. Yes, I.